Bill Rosenberg. I'm policy director and economist at the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions, and I've been asked at very short notice to chair this meeting tonight. So it's a pleasure to be here. This meeting, just to be sure you're at the right place and you're not here for a church service, is a public meeting on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is being negotiated as we speak across the road in the casino. The meeting is hosted by CPP Watch. We've got a lineup of four speakers this evening, and we'll have questions at the end, although one of the speakers, Mike Smith, has to leave by 7:30, so it's probably best if I've got any questions for him, if that's okay with him, to ask those following his talk. So our first speaker is Jane Kelsey, Professor Jane Kelsey, Professor of Law at Auckland University, who will be well known to many of you. Jane has specialised in the area of international agreements, particularly focusing on investment and services, and has written widely on this and spoken around the world on these subjects, so an acknowledged expert. So I'd like to introduce to you Jane Kelsey. Thank you.
Bill, and just to explain, Robert Reid, we thought, was going to be chairing tonight from the National Distribution Union, and he's had to go to Wellington, so these things happen. And then, of course, in the midst of all of the things that have been going on, I went and left my note up in the photocopier at the law school as well. So, kia ora koutou. It's really nice to see familiar faces, some I haven't seen for a very long time, and some new faces. This meeting was designed to give people who are interested in learning a bit more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations that are taking place across the road in the casino, as Bill said, this week. Give an opportunity to learn a bit more and hopefully to take that information out to other communities that you're a part of. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or we'll just refer to it as the TPP or the TPPA, is a very unusual kind of agreement. It is an agreement currently involving negotiations between 9 countries. In addition to the US and New Zealand, it involves Peru, Chile, Australia, Singapore, Brunei, Malaysia, and Vietnam, which is an interesting mixture of countries. That means that the particular scale of the agreement is unusual. The negotiations are a bit like herding cats, which may be an advantage to those that would like to see the negotiations go extremely slowly. But it also is an unusual agreement because of its scope. It's referred to as a free trade agreement. But in fact, it's not really very much about trade at all. Not in the way that we understand trade as things that go across the border, you know, like motor cars or clothing or slabs of butter. It's a much broader ranging agreement whose implications are going to be very severe for the range of choices that we will get to make in the next indeterminate period of time. When they talk about it as an agreement for the 21st century, it potentially is an agreement that will bind the hands of our governments for the whole of the 21st century. It's not easy to change these agreements, and it's extremely difficult to back out of these agreements. So once they're done, they're there, they're binding, and enforceable on our governments, not in our own courts, but in international tribunals that are usually conducting their hearings in secret, and where we as citizens have no say, and often where, in fact, we don't find out that there is even a dispute taking place until it has been concluded. So I want to touch tonight on three aspects of this agreement. A little bit more about what kind of an agreement we're talking about, then to give some examples of the way that it might affect us, and thirdly, to talk about some of the problems about the process of these agreements. Now, to go back to the question about what kind of agreement is this, when I say it's not really about trade, that might sound a bit strange, because those of you who've seen the sort of pre-publicity on this for the last couple of years will think it's all about Fonterra being able to sell more dairy in the US, because that's what usually the media coverage says it's about. But there are three reasons why this agreement isn't really about old-fashioned trade. The first is that the nine countries involved already have a whole raft of free trade agreements between each other. So they already largely have access into each other's countries without any restrictions on their goods. The second reason is that many of them voluntarily, like New Zealand, have actually removed almost all of their tariffs, their taxes at the border, and their quotas, their restrictions on the amount of imported products that can come in. Now, we have no restrictions on the amounts of garments, we have no tariffs on the import of motor vehicles and so on anymore. We used to, but they've all gone quite a long time ago. And that's what ordinary old-fashioned trade agreements will be designed to remove. The remaining restrictions, such as those on our dairy products into the US, are the ones that are very sensitive in those countries and aren't going to go. And it's been made very clear to us that the trade part of these negotiations, for example, between New Zealand and the US, where New Zealand wants to get dairy into the US will simply say, no. In the Australian negotiations with the US, Australia wanted to get sugar into the US. The sugar industry is really powerful in the US, and the US simply said, no sugar. And we can expect the same for dairy. And in fact, there's an article on the table at the back there where Joseph Stiglitz, when he was out in New Zealand a couple of years ago, said, there is no way in the world that the US will give New Zealand agricultural access. So if the selling point about trade isn't what it's really about, what is this agreement really for? This agreement is basically an agreement to guarantee, protect, and allow to be enforced the rights of foreign investors from the countries that are involved. It's an investment agreement. And those of you who remember warmly the campaign against the multilateral agreement on investment, this is the MAI revisited in a much larger and scarier form. Ultimately, what the negotiators want to do is to make it easier for big corporations to operate seamlessly across the nine countries involved. That means the various restrictions, not only on them being able to enter countries, but to have the kinds of rules that maximise their profitability, that's what the agreement is seeking to achieve. So it wants to remove obstacles, what they call barriers, to the ways that foreign investors can operate in New Zealand. And of course, the biggest issues for us, if we look at who the biggest investors already are in New Zealand, Australia and the US, if those investors get even bigger rights to have their way in New Zealand, then we have real issues of sovereignty. And that is part of the contest in these negotiations. Is it the citizens' rights? Is it the rights of tangata whenua? Or is it the rights of corporations that should have greater power in determining our policies and our direction for the next 100 years? Now, I mentioned that this agreement is sold as an agreement for the 21st century. And many of us, if we think about the challenges of the 21st century, those challenges we've already seen some of. Financial instability and potential meltdowns. Climate change. Indigenous rights that are part of an ongoing struggle, not only here, but in many of the other TPP countries, Australia, Peru, Chile. Other challenges are the chronic inequalities that seem to grow more and more as the corporations get more power. As the bonuses increase at one end, the poverty increases at the other. As the corporate welfare and the bailouts increase, then the price that's paid is by those who have the welfare cuts, the education cuts, the health cuts to pay for the bailouts. We know that job insecurity is a major issue because strong unions are the enemy of big profits. We know that there is a pending energy crisis and peak oil. What happens when the oil starts to run out? What happens when the forestry and the fisheries start to be depleted to the point where they're not actually available for locals to access? Now, all of those are challenges that if the governments were going to genuinely negotiate an agreement that is fit for the 21st century, are the challenges that they should be addressing. But that's not what's on the table. What's on the table is to take the kind of neoliberal policies that we've had here since 1984, the kind of unfinished business that Don Brash in his 2025 task force report is saying we need to undertake, and to multiply that by about three. And that is what is on the table in these negotiations. And so we face a really serious question of if our governments lock us into that model that is not only binding but enforceable both by the foreign governments and the foreign investors, if our government deviates from that pathway, we have some pretty serious problems. So those who are in central and local government should be asking what is happening across the road in the Sky City Casino, but most of them don't know, because we have a sort of an obsession in this country that free trade is a, I was going to say, religious belief that we cannot question. And they don't want to address the realities of what these negotiations are about. And even the negotiators admit, yesterday they said, this actually isn't an ordinary FTA. This is about the behind-the-border barriers to business. So what are some examples of the kinds of things that we might not be able to do in the 21st century? Well, there's a few that are quite topical. We've seen a really interesting backlash in the last couple of years around foreign investment. Our governments for the last 20 plus years have been throwing the door open wider and wider and wider to any foreign investors that want to come with a rubber stamping. And in a whole series of free trade agreements, they've actually promised each time to lock in the existing rules so that they couldn't introduce more restrictive rules on foreign investors. And so we already are pretty well locked in to a high threshold before we get to vet foreign investors. And the government's kept only a very small loophole. It's got a bit of a loophole for fishing quotas. It's got a bit of a loophole in terms of shares in Air New Zealand and telecom following the privatisation issues. And it's kept some rights to vet sensitive land, especially rural land. And so you might remember when there was the proposal to sell Auckland Airport to the Canadian Pension Fund, and Labor thought this actually wasn't such a good idea. It'd be nice if they thought that about some other things before then, but at least they thought that about the airport. And then Treasury said to them, oh, sorry, can't do that. Can't pass a law to say that we'll keep the airport in New Zealand ownership, because you've signed away the right to do that in the agreement with Singapore. Unless you can develop some new regulations under this loophole, and you know, it's a bit more complicated than this, but the loophole of sensitive rural land was how they managed to develop new regulations that said that we couldn't sell the airport. But just think about TVNZ. If National wants to sell TVNZ, it isn't exactly sensitive rural land. So foreign investment is an issue, and we're starting to rethink it. Labor's starting to rethink it. But Labor is now finding that what it signed earlier, its hands are tied on. We saw National planning to have a review on foreign investment laws to make it easier still for foreign investors. We weren't quite sure how they were going to make it easier, but and then because of the backlash of the Save the Farms campaign and a range of others, they actually did a review that tightened things up a little bit. But they only tightened it up on the rural land sector, because that's the loophole. So what is being sought in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is even more binding restrictions on our ability to do even those small amounts of rethinking. In addition to that, there's a proposal that the foreign investors might get the power to sue our government directly rather than relying on their own governments in secret international courts. Now, this sounds a bit far-fetched. Indeed, when John Key was asked by Scoop reporter Alistair Thompson about this investor state process, he said, oh, no, that sounds far-fetched, until it was pointed out to him by Rod Donald in the House that we've actually already signed four free trade agreements that have given foreign investors these powers, including the Chinese investors. But the US investors, this will be much more serious for, because they're litigious. They go to court all the time. Yeah? And they're pretty stroppy, as we saw with Warners. Yeah? And if they don't like the way that New Zealand is developing policies or regulations that they think are going to impede their profitability, not only under a TPP would they be likely to have a right to be consulted and have a say before the new policy or law is passed, but if it is passed and they don't like it because they say it's going to impede their profitability or expropriate the value of their company, then they can threaten to take New Zealand to the secretive World Bank court called ICSID for damages or compensation for their losses from those new policies or laws. So who is running the country? Now, that could apply, let's think of some examples. Seabed and foreshore. Seabed and foreshore is not about us going to the beaches. Seabed and foreshore is about who controls the minerals under the seabed. Or who controls the iron sands. And we're already seeing the exploration licenses for the petroleum companies being granted in an industry that has very little regulation. And we know from the BP saga that it can be devastating. Devastating to the aquaculture and the ecosystems and the beaches and the jobs and the local communities. But if you let them in without the regulations and you have a TPP that guarantees the rights of those investors not to have the profits and value of their investment eroded by new regulations and laws that are tighter, then what's the government going to do? Is it going to compensate the big mining companies in ways that actually mean they don't pay for the mess and they don't have to deal with the consequences of their actions? It's actually us, the taxpayers. And us, the taxpayers, means, like the corporate welfare for the banks, it comes out of the health budget, it comes out of the education budget, it comes out of the welfare budget, and so on. If we look at some other examples where this could occur, it was an issue that came up in a discussion we had today about the impacts of these rules on workers. Now remember ACC, when National was in power last time, ACC basically farmed it out to a whole lot of private insurance companies. When Labor came back to power, they took it back into a state-run ACC system. Those insurance companies didn't like it because they'd had a guaranteed stream of income, and they said, that's taking away the value of our investment. Now we know that National's planning to do that again. If Labor was elected again, would it, under a TPP, be able to reverse it again? Well, the investment companies like AIG from the US would say, that's expropriating the value of our investment. You're going to do this to ACC, you need to compensate us for our loss of profits from privatised ACC. Another example that I think is really quite interesting is telecom. I mean, we all know how telecom, when it was privatised, rorted us. Yeah? It had a monopoly and it didn't invest, it took all the profits out of the country and it did whatever it liked. And governments were really reluctant to do anything about it because telecom was the biggest company on the stock exchange, and if there was a crisis in telecom share value, the stock exchange, which is itself a private company now, would lose heaps of value. And so telecom was lightly regulated. That's why our cell phone costs and so on are so high, and why the problems with the internet access, the internet firms and so on, accessing the circuits. And one of the ironies under this agreement, which we might quite like, is that they would say, okay, we want competition rules that will make telecom be truly competitive and allow others to come in and compete. You know, Vodafone and, what's that, number two or 2 degrees? And we might think that's really good. But then the Business Roundtable has already said making telecom unbundle the loop, as it's called, is expropriating the value of telecom shares because they plummeted after this was announced. And so telecom should be compensated for having to open up to its competitors. Now, hold on, is this the same telecom that's rorted us for years? Now, under a TPP, if Telecom's Australian or US shareholders wanted to challenge that, they could say, we want compensation. They could run the case in these secret offshore courts. plain packaged tobacco, cigarettes. Another issue in the media. Māori Party's been running this, or Hone Harawira's been running this really interesting campaign about the impacts of health, impacts on health of tobacco, and in particular the high consumption for Māori. And so there's been suggestions of plain packet cigarettes, and there's been suggestions from Tariana Turia that the health sector should have to pay towards the costs of the damage that they do at the healthcare budget. But what we end up with is Philip Morris doing what they've already done. They went under this North American Free Trade Agreement, US, Canada, Mexico, to the Canadian government, said, oh, your plan to have these kinds of laws about tobacco, nah, that's taking away the value of our profits. We will sue you under NAFTA. They didn't even have to go anywhere near the court. Canada folded. At that time, they were a US company. Same Philip Morris now becomes a Swiss company because it wants to sue Uruguay over its proposals for plain packaged cigarettes. And there is an investment agreement that allows it to sue between Switzerland and Uruguay. Australia's talking about plain packaged cigarettes, and Philip Morris, in the lead-up to these TPP negotiations, is saying, yeah, that's one of the things we don't want Australia to be allowed to do, thank you. So who makes our health policy? And who pays for the damage? Now, all of those are classic kinds of examples, and there are many, many more that we could give. I just really want to talk about one further one that you might have seen in the news. We are really, even though we moan about our health system, still pretty privileged because medicines are basically pretty affordable here. And they're subsidised and they are bought by the government through a system called PharmAc. And PharmAc, the way it approaches the buying of medicines, makes the drug companies accept a lower price than they would if they were selling them at the market price that the drug companies want to sell them at. Now, of course, most of the drug companies are US companies or European companies, and the European companies basically operate also out of the US. So under a TPP, those fellas would have an influence over PharmAc. And the big drug companies have already said, and Sonia will refer to this further in a moment, they are saying we want the intellectual property chapter of this agreement to say that PharmAc can't operate like that anymore. And it's going to have to pay the mega prices for medicines that we expect them to. Bye-bye PharmAc. Bye-bye affordable medicines. Blow out health budget. Either fewer medicines on the public expenditure, or if they keep public medicines at the current level, less money for all the other things that we need. And so if we look at almost every sector, and I could talk about PPP prisons and water and all the kinds of new privatisations that we could expect from a National Act government, hopefully Labor has rethought that, a financial transaction tax, stop the hot money flowing in and out of the country, it makes us the casino of the money markets. That's going to be a problem. Now, if this is what the future for the 21st century looks like, is this what we really want? No. So, how are they getting away with it? Because the negotiations are secret. Number one. And we've been having briefings each afternoon by our negotiator, who says, well, I can't actually tell you what any party's government's position is, and I can't actually tell you about any of the details of what we're discussing. And we have this 15-minute ritual where we ask questions and they tell us nothing. And this is called transparency. And we're the insiders. Well, we're not really the insiders. The real insiders are Fonterra and the US New Zealand Council and the other corporate representatives who really do have the ear of government. And so the negotiations, even for those who understand some of the speak, and it's a very exclusive speak, can't get to find out what's happening. But until we started running this campaign around the TPP, whoever had heard of it? Their ambition, they're in their fourth round of negotiations now, their ambition is to have it wound up at the time of APEC in Honolulu in November next year. Now, we think that that's overly ambitious, but it still, possibly, could be pulled off. What do we get to find out between now, when it's in Auckland and at least we can harass them on their doorstep, and November next year? Well, one of the things about these trade agreements, so-called, is that they don't actually have to release the text that they're working on. So until they've completed it and signed it off, no one actually gets to see what they've been negotiating. And those who get to sign it off aren't the Parliament, they're the Cabinet. So the Cabinet can give the instructions to the negotiators, see the text, talk to those they want to, sign it off, make it a done deal, and then plonk it on the table and say, OK, this is your constitution for the next century. Now, we would never accept that in Parliament. We'd never accept the Cabinet making our laws. We would never accept us not seeing the text of a statute until it's passed. And so, yes, just as we've got this secret SIS select committee, at least we'll see the bill, we don't get to hear the submissions. Here we don't even get to see the text. And so that is an incredibly serious problem. Then we have the dilemma that even if we get the text, what do we do about it? Because up until now, Labor and National have had a consensus around free trade agreements. And even Winston, bless him, if he does a Lazarus number, was the foreign minister when the original US negotiations with four of those countries were announced. So Winston was infinitely pragmatic. Yeah? And so we have this dilemma that the parliamentary process, even if the agreement came before them, is not going to give us an effective say. Now, what we know is that the only way to deal with the transparency is what we call the Dracula principle, which is bring it into daylight, expose it, if they say it's so great, then justify it, tell us what it's about, debate it, and see what we can do. That's what happened with the MAI, and the MAI stalled. Well, we had the first leak this week on the intellectual property position of New Zealand, which is actually quite progressive, surprisingly. But the reason for leaking it was to lock in that position so they couldn't trade it off. But leaks actually are frustrating. Yeah? We shouldn't have to rely on leaks. But We'll take leaks rather than nothing else. So that's sort of the backdrop that I wanted to create for then some commentary on those kinds of challenges that confront us and some of the strategies from Mike and Sonia and Andrew, and then we can have some Q&A. Kia ora.